guests on the left-hand side of Rents.com. Find Harry Cooper's name. Look under his name. You'll see photos. And let's all click together. Click. Okay. So here we are, the year 2017. And the memories of World War II certainly fading. And it becomes harder all the time to really get a good grip, a grasp on things. Because it has been so perverted and corrupted by the special interest group that runs so much of the world through the banking industry and doesn't want anyone to know that it financed both sides of the war so they could make a fortune. This is what they do, and they're still at it. So history is rewritten constantly by the winners, and that's the way it is. So how do you find out the truth? One way you find out the truth about World War II history, in stunning detail, and really, if you've studied it through the mainstream media in shocking detail, is by joining Shark Hunters and letting Harry make these wonderful DVDs and books available to you. They are extraordinary. Right?
I agree with you, but then again, I'm kind of prejudiced. Incidentally, if your listeners want to save a ton of money...
you've got a sale going on. What's the deal there?
That's correct. Go to sharkhunters.com and then go to the click on store. Everything you see there, the hand-signed prints, all the books, the DVDs, the hand-signed autographed photographs, half price. Whatever price you see there, cut it in half. Place your order. But you got to order through Shark Hunters headquarters, not through our website, because it's too complicated to put in the codes. So... half price, unfortunately, the shipping, we can't cut that in half. Uncle Sam is not known for his generosity. But sharkhunters.com and go to store. Everything there is half price.
And there's some treasures there, real history.
There's some great stuff. The DVDs, a lot of them come right from the cameras of the soldiers in the field. Also gun cameras from the fighter planes, gun cameras from the Japanese fighter planes, too. We've got Japanese films on there that we got from an old Japanese film producer that he had locked in his vault. And then if your listeners want to send us an email, the email address is right on our website, but it's sharkhunters@earthlink.net. Send an email and say they listened to the show tonight. We'll send them the current issue free electronically. We'll send them to their email.
Yeah. So I don't know who puts those together, but the quality is such that you always want, you look forward to the next one. It's excellent. Just excellent. That couldn't
you,
be you, could it?
Yeah, I'm the guy that does it. That's why I'm working 12 hours a day.
Yeah.
Our 17th book came out last week. Our 18th book is coming out next week. And like I say, the Hitler in Argentina, that one is a bestseller, thank God. And again, it just all goes to Shark Hunters. Nobody here gets a salary. And I live on Social Security and whatever other retirement stuff I have. And I paid off my house before Obama got into office.
Wow.
Yeah, thank God for that.
Indeed.
So sharkhunters.com, store, everything you see there is half off.
Mm-hmm.
And send an email at sharkhunters@earthlink.net. Say you heard us on the Rents radio program. We'll send you the current issue of the magazine free. No strings attached. Free.
Thank you, sir. Very nice. We'll repeat that before the hour is up. Let's go to our pictures now.
Yeah, we got a lot more pictures than we're going to be able to cover. So the A1, or the A series, that's very important. One of the reasons that the... TV station in Buenos Aires wants to interview me is because it's known that two German submarines surrendered in the big submarine base down there at Mar del Plata months after the war ended. The one, if you're looking at picture A1, that's the submarine U-530. It surrendered 2.5 months after the end of the war in Mar del Plata, and I think it was 2 weeks after that, U-977 surrendered there. 530 was a Type 9. It had enough fuel. It could make that trip. But U-977 977 was a Type 7. He didn't have the fuel to get down there, and we don't know how he managed to get down there yet. And he wrote a book, the Skipper Schaefer. The name of the book was U-Boat 977. And in there he says he saved fuel by snorkeling for 66 days. Well, that's baloney.
Kind of don't buy that. Yeah.
No, because you have to, you know, you're running your diesel engines underwater.
Right.
But instead of pushing the sleek, streamlined hull through the water, you're also pushing the conning tower, the guns, the superstructure.
It's a big drag.
Yeah, increases your coefficient of drag something fierce. And I'm in contact with his son. I'm going to visit with his son when I get over to Germany later in the year. But the skipper of U-530 was a member of Shark Hunters. And one of our agents there, Pizarro, you've seen that name before.
Sure.
Pizarro interviewed Otto Wermuth. You look down to photo A3. That's Wermuth standing in the middle. And he told our agent a lot more than he told me. You look down a little bit to A4 and A5. That's a letter I got from him. And basically, because I asked him about it, and he left Kiel in February, and he showed up in Argentina in July. That's a long cruise.
Mm-hmm.
But he says there in the second paragraph, he said, we went to Argentina to the Mar del Plata, but we had no valuables, no silver, and no uranium on board. And that's possibly true.
It was no longer on board then.
Yeah, right. A5 was I think that's the surrender document. But you look at A8, that's Peter Hansen. He's member number 251 of Shark Hunters. We've got over 8,100 members, so he's been with us a while. On paper, he was just a lieutenant in the German Navy, Leutnant, which is their Leutnant is equal to our ensign.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, he was fairly high-placed Abwehr, which is the Secret Service. Mm-hmm. And
he's still a member now.
Oh, yeah. The guy is in his 90s.
Yeah.
And he is just an incredible treasure trove of information.
And now, where were he was on 530?
No. He was every time his whatever submarine he was attached to, every time it would get orders to ship out, he'd get transferred to another boat to keep him in there doing his spook work.
I see.
But when both U-530 and 977 arrived in Mar del Plata, Argentina, they claimed, and the history says, there was no paperwork on board at all of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
Even the sailors' ID cards, everything was thrown overboard. No paper at all, whatsoever. Yet in 1947, 2 years after the war ended, this guy, Peter Hansen, was sent down to Argentina, brought down by the Argentine Navy, to translate all the paperwork that was not on board those submarines.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked him about it, and he said, well, yeah, it was only diesel maintenance records and stuff like that. Okay, fine. When I went down there in 2008, the first time, the Argentine Navy was just absolutely super. They had me over there to the sub base at Mar del Plata, met with a bunch of their submarine officers and petty officers, and they hauled out two huge boxes, you know, the old banker boxes we used to call them, full of files, full of paperwork that was not on board those submarines. And yet, Peter Hansen says it was just diesel maintenance books. And No, it wasn't. It was log books. Unfortunately, I can't read German word diddly squat. And this was written in the old German, which younger Germans can't even read. But the Argentine Navy told me anytime I want to come back down there and look at them, I'm welcome. So one of these days I got to find a way to come down there and spend... It'll probably take a week or so.
Peter Hansen has never told his full story by a mile, then.
You're not kidding. Yeah. And there's more to his story that I'm not going to say while he's still living. But right. He's a great guy. He's a good friend. And this guy is an incredible fountain of knowledge. He knew Admiral Canaris, who was head of the Abwehr, until he wound up being executed. He knew him personally. He knew Admiral Dönitz personally. It's just incredibly sharp guy.
But going back to, obviously. Back to A3.
Back to A3.
They look like they're just in the process of surrendering. Because the guy on the right, the big, young, good-looking German crewman, his big guy, he's got his arm being held. I just noticed by that Argentinian sailor, and he's...
That's correct.
He look at the look on his face.
Buoy.
Well, it's not even that. It wasn't supposed to end this way.
That's right.
And then the guy on the lower left, of course, is... looks exactly like Jack Benny. But I don't think it was.
No,
but,
it was not Jack Benny.
Look at the pride, though, seriously. It's just amazing. Now, those boats, looking back at A1, the first one, U-530. That was a long-range boat. They looked to be state-of-the-art. They look to be as good or better than anything in that class of boat in the war.
In the beginning of the war, right.
Yeah. They look super. Remarkable technology.
Yeah. That was the Type 9C.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get our book, Hitler and the Secret Alliance, there's quite a bit in there about... The secret submarines down there. There were two submarines we know were there, 530 and 977. Yet when it came time to repatriate all these guys, they had three U-boat crews, not two.
Hmm.
So what's the third U-boat?
Wait, was
nobody knew.
Was
nobody
it scuttled?
Was talking.
You think?
Say again?
Was it scuttled? What happened to it?
Yeah, we're pretty sure we know which boat it was.
Mm-hmm. There may have been more yet that were coming and going.
There certainly were. We've got an aerial photo of two of them sunk in an area that's next to impossible to get to. You could get there probably if you had a ton of money, because it's in a little. It's off the shore of a little dinky town.
Isn't it kind of like a lagoon or a bay? Not a lagoon, but a bay?
Yeah, you're right. It's in Caleta de los Loros, which means Parrot Bay or Parrot Cove. And the water's not that deep. As a matter of fact, one lady, about 15, 20 years ago, she claimed she could see the superstructure at extremely low tide.
Well, let's get the boat out of there.
Yeah, let's go look at it.
They should get one. They're probably salvageable to a reasonable degree still.
But the outer, the outer stuff, the ballast tanks, that's all very thin, and that's gone by now.
But you should have one.
Prove.
Yes, and they may have been going to Antarctica and back. We don't know. We don't know.
We're finding there's more and more down in Antarctica that we're not supposed to know. As you know, I was in Monte Carlo this last July.
Yes.
With my associate, Annette. She had all the right contacts. We were talking to representative of Prince Albert. He was going to let us use his boat, he calls it. It's the size of a cruiser with a hospital on board and everything, and we had all sorts of experts lined up, people with drones that could get into places with cameras and everything, and we had financing set up. And all of a sudden, everything was shut off.
Well, when the American military will not let anyone get near anything of any value. What I think happened, I don't mean to speak for you on this, but I think, I suspect that the Germans went down there, as we know, in 38. 39,
yep.
And if they were in fact working with what are commonly called the reptilians, an off-planet intelligent species, that they may have been given a very large underground base to use down there, so they didn't have to go to all the trouble of digging through the ice and digging massive caves. There were said to be several underground facilities there, and one of them wasn't being used, basically. So they were given access to an enormous underground base, which they may still inhabit. We don't know. We don't know if the other two are still being manned by the so-called reptilians. Don't laugh. Stranger things have happened.
I've gotten to where I don't laugh about anything. You know, I don't believe it without seeing proof, but I don't dismiss it either.
Nothing. Agreed.
And I've heard these stories. I'm not saying they're true, but I'm saying we wanted to get down there, and all of a sudden everything was just, you know, shut off. You know, our phone calls weren't answered. The offers were withdrawn. And then about, what was it, 2 months ago, 3 months ago, I guess, one of the guys we were talking to who was going to provide a certain aspect, part of our tour, he beat the hell out of my associate there, Annette, and he beat up her little dog, too, for Christ's sake. Bad enough, you know, the guy's a wuss to beat up on a woman.
He actually beat her. He actually hit her.
Oh, yeah. Sent her to the hospital.
Well.
And the little dog, the dog is about 8 pounds.
Well, he's a real tough guy.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. B2. let's head into that. We had a severely damaged U-505 in the Caribbean.
Yeah, this is a whole different facet. This has nothing to do with South America or the spook works or any of that. But B-2, yeah, this is the most badly damaged submarine to make it back to its base. And it was hit off the mouth of the, I think, the Rio Orinoco or the Amazon, one or the other. Two planes came down to bomb it. One bomb hit right there. And the other one might have been that plane, but it was so low when the bomb went off, it just blew the airplane out of the sky.
Really?
And the pilot went down with his airplane. But here you see the back of the conning tower is blown out.
Yeah.
And the lower one, where it says B there, A is the back of the conning tower, B, it blew the torpedo right in half. They had under deck storage for extra torpedoes. Flip on down to, how the heck did we manage to get B1, B2, then B1, B2 again. Okay. You look to B3, you see the damage at the back of the conning tower. And then B4, excuse me, that's the torpedo blown in half. The half that's still there is the explosive warhead. The bomb blew the propulsion part out, the motor and fuel tank. If it would have hit a little further forward, that would have been the end of the sub. It would have blown up its own torpedo. And B-5 is more looking at it, but they made it all the way from South America back to Lorient, France. And then they started on...
What are we looking at in B-4, Harry? Why is the ocean so welled up back there in the background?
Oh, I guess that's the wake of the submarine going through it.
Almost looks like a depth charge, but it isn't.
No, it couldn't be, because that boat would have been dead, because it couldn't submerge. They finally got to where they could dive to 25 meters, which is...
With all that damage?
Yeah, well, they fixed the damage to the back of the conning tower, and that was the only part they needed to fix on the pressurized part. The pressure hull had not been hurt, in B4. It just blew out the torpedo, the half of the torpedo, and it blew the decking all to hell. And those are the exhaust pipes. You see the big, huge exhaust manifolds and on the back of the boat. But the pressure hull was not hurt. Only the back of the conning tower had that blown out, but they could just shut the lower hatch in the conning tower, and they could still submerge, but not very far. They made it all the way back to Lorient, but then started just a series of disasters. They were sabotaged every time you turn around. One time they went out and they dived, and the bombers kept dropping bombs almost right on top of them. When they finally got loose, they found out why. Somebody at the shipyard had drilled little holes in the top of the fuel tanks, and puttied up the holes with something that would hold until the boat got down under a certain pressure. Then it dissolved and it started leaking fuel. Another time, the electric motors didn't work because somebody had dumped iron filings in there. And somebody, some clever German GI, had handwritten over one of the pens, "This is U-505's patrol area," which pretty well unnerved the skipper to the point where he finally, when they were out and they were under depth charge attack, he just had enough, pulled out his pistol and shot himself in the head, and that was it for Peter Schesch. So this submarine had great luck, good luck, that it didn't get killed in that attack, but it had bad luck that it couldn't get anything else done after that.
The people working in the pens were obviously French partisans,
French
working
the
resistance.
Workers.
Yeah, and they were trying to sabotage the submarines.
Right. In the early days, though, the guy in charge of liaison with the dockyard workers was a guy named Lothar von Arnaud de la Perrier. He was a vice admiral, mm-hmm. but during World War I, he was a submarine commander. He sank more ships than anybody else in history. 198 ships he sank.
Good
grief. And while he was liaison officer...
A French submarine, World War I.
Yeah, no, he was a German submariner.
Okay.
He was from Alsace-Lorraine.
I got it. Okay, he's on that. I'd speak French there, yeah.
Yeah, so he was in charge of the dockyard workers. They were happy. They were well-treated, well-fed, well-paid. And one day, the magic paint on his airplane failed, and he crashed. He was going from France to Berlin for a meeting. I'm joking about the magic paint.
Right.
But his plane crashed. Accidentally, delivered, who knows. But then they put in some kind of hard-ass... you will do it because I say so, rather than here we're going to pay you. And that's when the sabotage started. And 505 was sabotaged pretty heavily. And like I say, the skipper blew his brains out. And then...
Well, here's picture B-6. It's a longboat is chasing 505 as she makes...
That's when it was being captured by the U.S. Navy.
Uh-huh.
And there's a film that the Navy made while they were capturing this submarine. And it was really interesting because Dan Gallery, the captain who was in command of the task group, he got, big pats on the back. He got medals for doing this. And then he almost got court-martialed because, first off, he wasn't supposed to capture a submarine. He was supposed to sink it. And they captured 505 on the 4th of June, 1944, 2 days before D-Day. And if the Germans would have found out that the boat had been captured, they would have known the codes were compromised and would have changed the codes.
Huh.
And the Allies would have been flying blind on D-Day,
mm-hmm.
as it was.
So we have to take a break. Hang on.
Okay.
So this boat was captured where?
Off West Africa.
Okay, and they made it all the way back to, they took it to the UK?
No, it was towed, it was almost sunk because they pulled the plug on it, and it was almost sunk, and they towed it into Bermuda.
So the crew tried to scuttle it,
yep.
But that's why it looks like it's sinking there, it was.
Oh, yeah.
And
the whaleboat is the U.S. Navy guys coming alongside to get aboard and keep it from sinking. Because Gallery wanted to capture a sub.
Huh. All right. Hold on a minute. We'll come right back. Fascinating. Okay, let's get right back to our fascinating walk into World War II history and German U-boats and some of the people who are still alive. Go ahead. This is fascinating. We're at B-8, I believe.
Right. Well, B-7 showed the American task force all around the boat, and you can see how she's just ready to go under. And B-8, that was Wayne Pickles. He was a member of Shark Hunters. He's passed on now. One of the first guys down the hatch of U-505. He had a 45 in his hand. He was ready to fight it out with any Germans left down there, but nobody was left, and they had the boat. But the thing was filling up with water, and we look at B-9. There's Wayne Pickles again, and, you know, quite some years older.
Mm-hmm.
This was in 1994, the 40th anniversary of the capture. And Lukosius, the guy on the right, Zenon Lukosius, he's the U.S. Navy guy who actually stopped the leak. They had taken the lid off a sea strainer and opened the valve to let seawater in. It was an 8-inch pipe, and the water was just pouring in.
Uh-huh.
Lukosius came aboard after the boarding party secured it, and he saw where the valve was. He just closed the valve, put the cover back on.
Amazing.
That was it. But the boat was ready to sink. It was neutral buoyancy.
Right.
And I'll tell you how they blew it out in a second. They're B-10.
Who's Peterson in B-9?
Peterson, Pete Peterson, he was, he's a German. He's passed on now, too. But he was on U-boat U-518.
Uh-huh.
He's the one who came to Chicago at the request of the museum there. Prior to this big deal on the 4th of June, and he got the diesel engines running. And so when we were all there on the 4th of June for the big D-Day celebration, it was over a weekend, I think, we were all sitting around, so we was making speeches, and then they said, well, like they say in NASCAR, gentlemen, start your engines. And Pete Peterson was on board the boat. We were all outside, and he lit off the diesels.
This is in Chicago?
Yes.
And this is 505?
Right.
Unreal. So they brought it back, and they repaired it. We'll get to that story, and it's still there.
Yeah. If you look at B-10, that's the submarine alongside the carrier.
Mm-hmm.
The carrier had to tow it to keep it from sinking, and they claimed that they got the props to windmill on the submarine and that charged the battery. That's just not true. There was a guy after the prisoners were all put on board the submarine, the carrier, I'm sorry, and you see in B-11, that's all the stuff they were taking off the submarine and the prisoners in the background. They found one of the guys, what the heck was his name? Well, it'll come to me in a minute. He was speaking Polish. So they pulled him aside real quick, and it turned out he was drafted. Nobody ever gets drafted into the U-boats. That's what they always said, but that's not true. He got drafted, and he was a machinist, a motormech, a motor
mm-hmm.
guy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they put all the conscripts down there. And all of a sudden they realize this guy's not happy with being on board a German submarine. So they pull him aside real quick. And then the very next day, he died. And one or two days after that, the engine started up on U-505. The pump started. They blew out the water. She was running at full surface trim. Everything was working. All these U.S. Navy carrier guys suddenly learned how to read German and knew how to work a submarine. They'd never been on a submarine before,
mm-hmm.
but they knew how to work a submarine.
Right.
Felix Ewald, that's the guy's name. So, poor old Felix, they buried him at sea. The next day, like I say, the engines worked. Everything worked fine. 3 days later, some of the 505 guys with their guard went into the latrine. Doggone, there's old Felix Ewald. And they hustled him out real quick, you know. His death was a sham.
Mm-hmm.
The funeral was a sham. He had told the American, the U.S. Navy guys how to run the submarine. So that's how they saved that submarine. And then she was scheduled for destruction. Like, there were captured German submarines. There were U.S. Navy ships that were no longer needed after the war was over in 1947, I think it was. And there was a guy, a U.S. Navy undersecretary of the Navy, he's signing destruction orders for this, that, and the other U.S. Navy ship. And then all of a sudden he's got this German ship, and they said, what the heck? So they found out this was not surrendered at the end of the war. This was captured on the high seas. And so there was a big push in Chicago to get it there, because Dan Gallery, the U.S. Navy commander of that task force, was from Chicago, and his brother was a priest in Chicago.
Hmm.
So they got the money together to save it. And you look at B-12, that was Otto Dietz.
I think, by the way, it's B-11 looks to me like it's aircraft carrier crewmen that are standing by looking at all this stuff. Look how they're standing.
Well, yeah, the crewmen were there, but the U-boat crew was locked up in another room right nearby.
Right.
This
is
all the stuff they're pulling off the U-boat.
How many of the U-boat crew survived?
Only one man was killed. The first guy out of the hatch, he wound up getting hit with a 40-millimeter, and that's the end of him.
Mm-hmm.
The captain got his leg blown off. Everybody else made it alive.
Amazing.
Yeah, they were very lucky. They jumped in the water, and they saw the whaleboat coming out. They thought, okay, they're going to pick us up. Then the whaleboat went on past them to put everybody on board the submarine. And some of the crewmen that I talked to from the German sub, they said they thought these guys were crazy. But they sent other whaleboats to pick up the prisoners. We've got that on a videotape, one of our DVDs.
They let a lot of German submariners drown that they could have saved.
Yeah, the Americans didn't do that much, but the Brits, they did. Yeah, they did. And when they sank Bismarck, they left a lot of them. They only rescued, I think, 80 or 81 people. They left the rest to die. The U.S. Navy guys were just super honorable, pretty much like the German U-boaters were in the early stages. They helped people in the water, but then they couldn't stay on the surface anymore. And the U.S. Navy guys were also very, you know, humane.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, capturing U-boat guys gave them valuable intel.
Right. Something about the German character, this is known through all wars, the Boer War, it doesn't matter. They just don't have a problem killing people. I don't know what it is about the Brits. Not all of them, but this is what's said about them. They will kill. That's what they do.
There's another whole topic there.
Yeah.
What they did to the French fleet, but that's another story.
Yeah, well, we need to talk about that sometime.
Sure.
Otto Dietz.
He was a pharmacist mate on board U-505, and he had quite a story, which is lengthy, but he was on board first. He was on U-180, which was a rare boat. It was a Type 9 D-1. They only made two of them. And he was on the patrol with that boat from Germany into the Indian Ocean with Subhas Chandra Bose, the guy who was organizing the Indian National Army. And so as a pharmacist mate, he didn't have a lot to do. So he talked a lot to Subhas Chandra Bose and his assistant, Dr. Abad Hassan, and he told us a lot about these guys. But then he had a slight problem. He got drunk a lot.
And loose lips.
One time he was coming back to his boat, U-180, stone drunk, and as he came on board, bottles fell out of his uniform, so they sent him to the Russian front. And he was lucky the sniper that got him wasn't a very good shot and just put holes in him. So he wound up in a hospital in Hamburg. And when he got recovered, they said, hey, you're a medic. We need medics here. So they put him to work in a hospital. Then the first officer from U-180, who was Harold Lange, was coming through the hospital because he was dating one of the nurses. He saw Otto. He says, hey, look, I'm going to take over my new command, U-505, and you're coming with me. So Otto was a great guy. He was with us every time we'd go to Germany, but he's passed on now, unfortunately. But what a neat guy.
Yeah, well, stories. Countless
stories. And if you
look
at B-13, that's Otto Dietz again in 1970-something. That's the sign they put up on Lakeshore Drive.
Mm-hmm.
1954, when they were going to haul the submarine across the lake, the drive, in B-14. September 1954, it was Labor Day, and they're getting ready to drag the submarine across the beach, then across Lakeshore Drive to the Museum of Science and Industry.
So who repaired the boat? American craftsmen, machinists, and so forth?
Well, after the bombing attack, no, the Germans did, but then after we captured it, yeah, the U.S. Navy. And the U.S. Navy recommissioned the boat as USS Nemo, which means no one, but they didn't operate the boat.
Well, what's fascinating is after all of that, sitting for years, that the engines would start right up. That's some kind of quality construction.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They built them well.
Yeah.
So this was Labor Day. We got stuck in a traffic jam going around. We picked up my dad, who worked down in the Gold Coast in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
And we're going around. There were no superhighways and expressways in those days. We were going down Lake Shore Drive. We got stuck in this traffic. And it was my birthday, my 15th birthday. And I saw this thing out there, and I'm thinking, who the heck would want this thing? Well, now I know. It's a valuable piece of history.
Wow.
The only enemy warship captured by the U.S. Right. Navy since the War of 1812.
So it was all repaired back at the Penn, and I went back out again, and that's when
I got captured.
Unreal.
And B-15, that's the fellow who earned the nickname the Weasel. He was, when I first met him, he let us know that he was the executive officer on the submarine. And then I got to talking to him. I said, wait a minute, my record shows I was somebody else.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah, he said, that's a mistake. I was the centrale mate, the chief petty officer in the central control room.
Right.
No, his rank was Matrosa Suaita, seaman or sailor second class, one step above a boot.
Uh-huh.
And the thing he's holding in his hand is the lid, the sea strainer lid. He claimed that he pulled the plug. He opened that sea strainer, and he got his 15 minutes of fame, and it turns out it wasn't him after all. It was the engineering officer.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell was his name? Holenried. No,
so
Holenried was the engineering mate, petty officer. Hauser. Hauser was the and a chief engineer. He's the one who opened it up. This guy did nothing, but
survived.
Yeah, he was member number 3 in Shark Hunters. We threw him out because we found he was buying reproduction U-boat combat badges.
Oh, that's the guy.
Yep, and he was selling them all at the military shows. Yeah, das war meine Kriegsbezeichnung.
Mm-hmm.
No, it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, that's the. The story of U-505, probably the luckiest and the unluckiest submarine in the German U-boat fleet. And for the longest time, it was the only Type 9C left in the world. But then, what was it, 15, 20 years ago, this one diver, Agi Jensen, who's a professional diver and in the Kattegat, which is the sea area to the east of Denmark. He was hired by a wealthy Dane to just dive and look for sunken ships.
Mm-hmm.
And he found U-534. Then it was not a war grave because everybody was able to get off the boat before it got sunk. It was sunk in the last one or two days of the war. And they expected to find Nazi gold. Everything had Nazi gold. And so they finally raised it, and the guy who was in charge of the salvage was a guy named Lars Peterson, who's a member of Shark Hunters, a good friend of mine. And now that began the biggest goat rodeo. They got it to the surface. They got it into a shipyard in Denmark. It's not like a speedboat that you can park in your driveway. This thing is 252 feet long. Now you raised it. Now you got it in the shipyard. What do you do with it? Well, the press at the time was joking. The only thing they found on board was a couple cases of condoms. Well, if you wanted your horse to have safe sex, that would be a condom. But no, these things were balloons shaped like hot dogs, big ones. And they would be filled up with hydrogen, because Germany didn't have access to helium. They'd be filled with hydrogen and floated above the submarine trailing aluminum strips called Aphrodite. That's your early form of chaff.
I'll be darned.
To foil any radar.
Uh-huh.
So, but then it's sitting in the shipyard for the longest time. Now, the shipyard wants to get paid for this. They darn near had to break it up for scrap, and finally they found a museum in Birkenhead, England, the Nautilus Museum, Ship Museum, and they had a bunch of British Navy ships that were all in the water there. But this one they put in concrete bunkers on the shore, much uh-huh. like U-505 is in Chicago or U-995 uh-huh. in Germany. And it was a separate ticket booth and a separate profit center, separate entity.
Uh-huh.
Okay, fine. Well, all of a sudden, the warehouses that was on that property, they got sold to be converted into high buck flats. So they told the museum, you got to get your stuff out of here. Okay, all the floating ships that belonged to the British part of the museum, they just towed them to another area. U-534, unfortunately for them, couldn't be towed because it was on shore in concrete bunkers. And boy, oh boy, they had lawsuits after lawsuits. They were just about to break it up again when the Merseyside Ferry Boat Company, you know, the old Mersey Ferry mm-hmm. Cross the Mersey song,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
they bought it, and they brought it to their ferry terminal, cut it into five pieces, and I guess put plexiglass over each end so you could look in, and that's where it's at. So that now there's two Type 9 Cs left in the world.
Hmm. Wow, it's still there.
Yeah, it's, oh yeah, they made a
That's an enormously large boat when you think about a submarine. Almost, well, 250 feet. That's pretty well the length.
252 feet.
Yeah.
Yeah, about 11 or 1,200 tons. But, of course, compared to the American submarines of the day, it's not that big. Mm-hmm. Our boats, the fleet boats, were 312 feet mm-hmm. and displaced, I think it's 2,500 or 2,600 or 1,600, mm-hmm. something like that.
Mm-hmm.
They were much bigger because German boats could leave their harbor, and they'd be into combat territory within a few days. The U.S. Navy guys, they had to go weeks before they could even get into their assigned area because, you know, coming from either Hawaii or later on Midway mm-hmm. or Australia, they had to go all the way across the Pacific Ocean, so they had to carry a bunch more fuel, more food, etc. So they were a lot bigger, a lot longer, and they had some sort of crew comfort. They had an actual wardroom where the guys could sit down and eat their meals, and they had showers on board the American submarines, whether they got to use them or not depended on their situation. The German boats, they had no wardroom. The guys ate at their duty station or at their bunk.
Mm-hmm.
Shower was non-existent.
Mm-hmm.
So they were meant to go out and fight and come back. That was it. Whereas the American boats at least had a little bit of comfort.
Tell our listeners how many didn't come back.
Oh, so the German U-boats, holy cow. They sent out a little over 1,000 boats went out on patrol, and about 800 did not come back.
Yeah. They lost over 35,000 crew.
Well, I think about 30,000 out of 39,000.
Uh-huh.
As a comparison, the U.S. Navy submarine force had the worst attrition rate of any branch of the U.S. military. One man out of seven got killed. That's a hell of a loss ratio. But on the German side, it was just the opposite. One man out of seven came home. And we have never, in 34 years of doing this, we've never found one case of desertion. And at the end of the war, they were the only oversubscribed branch of the German military. People were standing in line to sign up. We've got members now today who were cadets in the German U-boat school when the war ended.
Amazing. So, and it all has to do with the Enigma machine and breaking that code, or things would have been a lot different.
Well, that was a huge thing, breaking the code, and it all happened in May of 1943. They call it Black May.
Yeah.
The codes were broken, and Hufduff came into being. That's High Frequency Direction Finder, HFDF, Hufduff. Used to be, it took 10 or 15 seconds to get a line on a radio broadcast. So the German guys developed what they called a Kurt signal, quick signal, just a quick little blast, just and within 1 second they were done transmitting, and you could not get them on the old RDF, radio direction finder, where you had to turn a loop, etc. With Huffduff, as soon as that guy hit the key once, bang, he was triangulated. There were lines drawn from, there were big stations on the U.S. and on the French coast, or England, I'm sorry, and other ships at sea that had the receivers. As soon as that guy hit the key, bang, he was triangulated, and within 15 minutes, bombers were overhead, and he was gone. The German U-boats lost almost as many submarines that month alone as the U.S. Navy lost in the entire war through combat. The U.S. lost 52 boats, but only about, I think, 48 of them through combat. Four of them were sunk, hit a reef, crashed into their guide or whatever. But the U.S. Navy lost 48 by combat through the whole war. The Germans lost 44 that month alone. After that, it was a one-way trip.
Wow. Wow. All right. One last quick look, and we'll finish next time. Very intriguing picture. C-1. These boats appear to be two pieces, not complete.
No. Actually,
what is it?
Those are two separate submarines. Those are Type 2 submarines.
Yeah, I got that much, but it looks like they're not the back end. The front end, the torpedo end, is that, if that is the front end.
That's
is
the front
there.
End, yeah, three torpedo tubes.
And where's the back end? It's not there.
The back ends are on two other barges.
That's what I thought. They built
these
them in segments,
six,
yeah.
Six of these Type 2 boats were brought out of service. First off, they had been combat boats. Then they were training boats in the Baltic. Then they were cut in half like this, loaded on barges, floated down the Danube, and where they came out at Constanza, Romania, in the Black Sea, they were put back together again, recommissioned into the, I think, the 33rd flotilla, and these six boats chased Soviet shipping in the Black Sea.
Yeah.
Well, they were very, very resourceful, these Germans.
Yeah, I'd say. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
We are just about out of time. Let's... We're going to look at the rest of these pictures where you can look at them, and we'll have Harry explain what they are in his next visit. So what do we want to remind people of? We want to remind them about the sale, which is going on right now.
Half off everything. Go to sharkhunters.com and click on store. Everything in there is half off except for the shipping. Shipping Uncle Sam controls that. Also, send us an email at sharkhunters@earthlink.net. And say you heard us on Rents, you want a pre-copy of the magazine, we'll send you the current issue, no strings attached.
All right, sir. Thank you. That was terrific. Wow.
Thank you.
We covered
always
a lot of ground.
To be on your show.
Yeah, we had a great time, and we'll do it again next month.
Sounds like a plan.
All right. Take care, Harry.
Thank you, Jeff. You too.
Thanks.
God bless America.
Indeed. All right. We'll be right back with hour number three in just a minute.